Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
We're back discussing the Torah portions. This week, we're looking at the portion of Baha'alotcha, which goes from Numbers 8:1 through 12:16. We've already read the portion ahead of time, but if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll get into discussing.
In Baha'alotcha, the people of Israel mark a year since leaving Egypt by keeping Passover in the wilderness of Sinai, after which Israel finally sets out from Sinai to travel to the Promised Land. But they immediately begin complaining and testing their God.
So this portion begins with Adonai speaking to Moses and telling him to go ahead and set apart the entire tribe of Levi for the service of the tabernacle. We'd already read in previous portions that God had said that he was going to take the entire tribe of Levi to himself to help the priesthood, the sons of Aaron, in their service as they do all the sacrifices and all the holy work in the tent of meeting. He had said that the firstborn of all Israelis belong to God, but in this case, he's taking the entire tribe of Levi in place of their firstborn. And so here in chapter 8, we see God actually doing that. He's saying, consecrate the tribe of Levi, purify them, set them apart, make offerings for them, and then also take the entire tribe of Levi and present the Levites, as a wave offering to God. In verse 14, God says, thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. We've actually seen similar language to this used in regards to the entire people of Israel, when God said that he separated the people of Israel to be his from among all the other peoples of the earth. And also we saw how God had separated out specifically Aaron and his sons to be his priests and to serve him. So this is a pattern that we've seen multiple times now, which is God separating people to himself, separating them to be his and to serve him in a unique way. He set apart the entire people of Israel to serve him in a unique way. And then from them, he separated out the tribe of Levi. And then from them, he separated out the sons of Aaron. And all of these groups have a specific holy job to do for God. And similarly, we see Yeshua praying over his disciples in John 17 when he says, I have given your word to them, and the world hated them because they are not of the world as I am not of the world. Set them apart in the truth. Your word is truth. So in the same way that God separated out the priests to serve in the Mishkan and to offer sacrifices, in the same way they set apart the Levites to do the service of the Mishkan and to help the priests and to carry the tabernacle and all that, and in the same way they set apart the whole people of Israel to be God's treasured possession and kingdom of priests and to shine God's light of salvation to the ends of the earth, in the same way, we as followers of Messiah have been set apart from the rest of the world. We have been separated to God in order to proclaim his truth. God's truth sets us apart and gives us the ability to proclaim that truth to the world.
And more than being separated for God, we're also like the Levites in that we're supposed to be presented as an offering to God. Paul calls upon us to present yourselves to God as a sacrifice, living, holy, acceptable to God, your logical service. So just as the Levites were being offered to serve God, so also we should be offering ourselves, and we should be offering ourselves for service to God. And part of that offering is being holy. Before the Levites could offer themselves, they first had to purify themselves, and they had to have atonement made on their behalf. All of this was to make them holy so that they could be offered to God, so that they could serve God. So also, we as followers of Messiah have been made holy through the cleansing of Yeshua's sacrifice. And so now that we're holy, we need to offer ourselves so that we can serve God in that holiness. So at this point, the people of Israel have been out of Egypt for nearly a year. And so God says to Moses, it's time for Passover. God had told the people of Israel that they were supposed to keep the night of Passover, the night when God set the people of Israel free from Egypt, as a memorial forever through all their generations. So every single year on the first month, on the 14th day of the month, they're supposed to keep Passover as a memorial to that first Passover. And so now it's been a full year, so it's time for the first memorial. So Moses told all the people and they got ready and they kept Passover. And so the first Passover that the people of Israel kept after leaving Egypt was kept at the foot of Mount Sinai. This is where the people of Israel have been receiving the Torah from Moses. This is where the people of Israel set up the Mishkan and consecrated the priesthood and established the sacrificial system. And so now, after all of that foundational preparatory work for the people of Israel, they're kind of capping it off with keeping Passover, with the remembrance of what God did for them in bringing them out of Egypt.
Now, even though the entire people of Israel is keeping Passover at Mount Sinai, the portion does say that there are a few Israelis who aren't able to keep the Passover. It says that they're unclean because they've been around dead bodies. And as we've seen in other places in Scripture, you aren't allowed to eat God's sacrifices when you're unclean. And the Passover is a sacrifice. So these guys come to Moses and say, everyone's keeping Passover, but we can't. But it's the time, it's the day to keep Passover, so what should we do? And Moses basically says, wait here, I'll be right back, I gotta go talk to God. And so then God tells Moses, all right, we'll make an exception here. If people are unclean and unable to eat the Passover on the 14th night of the first month, or if they're on a long trip or something, if for some reason they're unable to keep the Passover in the place that Adonai puts his name, then in that case, they can have Passover a month late. They can do it on the evening of the 14th day of the second month. But then God makes sure to say, but if you're perfectly capable of doing Passover at the right time and then you don't do it, then that's sin and that's really bad.
So this is different than most of the commands that God has given up to this point, in that instead of it just being God says something to Moses, it's specifically the people of Israel have a problem that wasn't specifically mentioned in the rest of God's commands. And so they come to Moses, and then Moses specifically goes to ask God, what do we do in this case? Mm. And then God gives a specific set of instructions. This is actually a pattern that we'll see a few more times in the Torah. The people of Israel have a specific situation, and they go to Moses, and Moses goes to God for a specific answer. And so we see that Moses' response, when presented with a problem that wasn't in God's commands up to that point, was, wait, that I may hear what Adonai will command concerning you. So Moses' response isn't just, oh, there's no specific case for this in the Torah, guess we just gotta make it up. Instead, Moses knows that the only option is always to follow God's command. And so when not given an explicit answer in what God already commanded, his response was to be patient and to listen. So he's seeking out God's will, and he's not pushing ahead until he knows what God's will is. Mm. And so I think this can be a practical example for us to follow as well. Scripture doesn't contain a specific solution to every specific problem, but Scripture has all the commands that we ever need, and we should always frame our lives around God's commands, not making up our own rules when we think that God didn't cover our situation. So when we don't see an explicit answer to our problems in the Scriptures, what we should do is we should be patient and we should seek out God's will. We should seek the answer from His Word, and eventually we will find it if we're prioritizing following God's will over getting accomplished what we want to get accomplished or solving the problem that we want to solve.
And sometimes there are really, really, really specific things like, should I take this job or not take this job? Should I go to this place or not go to this place? There are some things that are very individual to the person. And in that case, Scripture might not even have precedent for that. But you can still seek what God commands by listening to His Spirit. You don't listen to what you want to do. You seek God and say, not my will, but your will, and submit to whatever God says He wants you to do. So next, the portion moves on to discuss what happens when the people of Israel move from one location to another. We're going to see a little bit later in this portion here that the people of Israel are going to leave Sinai and start going to various places. And so the portion is kind of jumping ahead a little bit and describing what it's like and how they do that. Basically, it says that there's the pillar of cloud and fire, and that is on the Mishkan by day and by night when the people of Israel need to stay put. But when God is ready for the people to move out, the cloud and fire lifts off the Mishkan, then goes in the direction that He wants the people to go. It's really interesting how it puts it here. It says, whether it was 2 days or a month or a long time that the cloud lingered over the tabernacle, staying above it, the sons of Israel remained and camped and did not set out. But when it was lifted, they did set out. At the command of Adonai, they camped, and at the command of Adonai, they set out. So basically, the people of Israel had no idea how long they were going to stay in one place, and they had no idea how far they were going to travel to the next place. They were doing it all based on what God was commanding them by moving the pillar or making the pillar of cloud stay. Israel's timing had to be entirely based on God's timing. This reminded me of something that's sort of related from the book of James, where it says, "Go now, you who are saying, today or tomorrow we will go on to such a city, and we will pass the time there for a year and do business and make a profit. You who do not even know the things of the next day. Instead of saying, if the master wants, we will live and do this or that, as it is, you boast in your pride. All such boasting is evil." Basically, with the people of Israel, they couldn't just assume they knew when God would want them to set out. They couldn't even base it on, well, we knew God had us camp for a certain time last time, so obviously we'll camp for this amount of time this time, and then we can plan forward. No, the people of Israel had to be relying on God for their timing and go when God wanted them to go. Yaakov here is saying, we need to only do things if the master wants. We need to submit all of our plans to God's timing, look to him for everything, and see, does he really want us to do this or not?
Now, we had seen in a previous portion that God had set up an almost military-like formation for the people of Israel and instructions on how to set up and move the camp in a very orderly fashion. Now God adds another instruction very much in line with that. He tells Moses to make 2 silver trumpets, and that these trumpets are going to be used for summoning the people and organizing the camp. Kind of like in the military, where different rhythms or different tunes can be used by instruments to signal to the army, these trumpets can be used in different ways to signal to the people of Israel what they're supposed to do. If they blow a long blast on both of the trumpets, it's telling the entire people of Israel to assemble at the tent of meeting. But if they only blow one of the trumpets, then that's saying, just assemble the elders and chiefs to the tent of meeting. And then they can also blow an alarm to tell the people of Israel it's time for the camp to start setting out to move, according to the formation previously established. But the trumpets are actually even more important than this, because God establishes them as a perpetual statute for the people of Israel throughout their generations. So even when they're not in the camp anymore, even when they get to the land, whenever they go out to war, they will bring these trumpets with them. And they will sound these trumpets at every one of the Moedim and the feasts, and also at every Rosh Chodesh, or the beginning of the month. And Moses says that these trumpets are a reminder of the people of Israel before God. So when the people of Israel blow these trumpets, whenever they go out to war, they're calling on God to remember them. And when God is with them, he will fight for them, and they will win. And so also, on all of their days of gladness, whenever they're celebrating, whenever they're having a feast or a moed and coming before God, they're blowing these trumpets, and God is remembering them.
Now, one more thing that I want to mention before we leave this section is that this verse puts the Moedim and Rosh Chodesh together in one breath, basically saying that the trumpets are for both of these days. Rosh Chodesh is the first day of the month, and it's not talked about a lot in Torah, but here it basically says that Rosh Chodesh is a special day. And as we see implied here in this verse, and also we'll see more explicitly later, there are specific offerings that the priests give on Rosh Chodesh. So in addition to the annual Moedim and also the weekly Moed of the seventh day Shabbat, there's also the monthly day of Rosh Chodesh, which is a special day for God. So next the portion moves on and says that the people of Israel finally leave Mount Sinai. It says the cloud that was on the tabernacle or the Mishkan, it lifts, and that signals to the people of Israel, it's time to move out. And so in the order that God had said previously, the different tribes go ahead and set out, and the Mishkan is taken down, and then they all head out. It says that this happens in the second month, in the 20th day of the month. So it said in Exodus that the people of Israel arrived at Mount Sinai on the third new moon. So that would be the first day of the third month. And so here, it's just a few days before the third month here. So they spent almost a year at Mount Sinai, and this is also a few days after late Passover, which we read about previously in this portion. And so now the people of Israel are setting out in all of their different tribes.
So while the people of Israel have been camped at Sinai, it says that Moses' father-in-law, Hobab, had been with the people of Israel at Sinai. So now, as the people of Israel are setting out, Moses says to Hobab, come with us. We're going to the promised land. Come follow us. And Moses says to Hobab, Israel will do good to him because God is going to do good to Israel. Hobab is at first hesitant to go, and he says, I should probably be getting back to my land and my people. But Moses says, please don't go. You know this land better than we do. So you can act as kind of like a scout for us. And he says, if you do go with us, whatever good God does to us, we will do to you. Mm. So Moses is basically promising Hobab a share of God's blessings to Israel if he will follow along and help the people of Israel. And we see from later passages in scripture that Hobab actually did end up going with the people of Israel. His descendants came to be known as the Kenites, and they settled in the land of Israel alongside the people of Israel. And we also see that Israel did end up returning the favor and doing good to the descendants of Hobab. In the days of King Saul, God commissioned the people of Israel to go and fight against the Amalekites in fulfillment of what he had said back in Exodus when Amalek had attacked Israel and God said he would make war with Amalek from generation to generation and wipe them out completely. Now the Amalekites had settled in the Negev of Israel, and by coincidence, that's also where the Kenites had settled. So when Israel went out to fight against the Amalekites, they went ahead and warned the Kenites in advance and said, get out of there. We're about to fight against the Amalekites, but we don't want to attack you because you were kind to us when we were coming out of Egypt. So because of this advance warning, all the Kenites were able to get out of the region, and the people of Israel were able to defeat the Amalekites without hurting the Kenites. So we see that when one nation decided to attack Israel, God promised to attack them. Mm. But when Hobab showed kindness to the people of Israel, Moses promised to do good to his people, just as God was giving blessing to Israel.
This goes back to what we read all the way back in Genesis 12, when God said to Abraham, those who bless you, I will bless, but those who hate you, I will curse. We're seeing that play out here. The difference between the Amalekites and the descendants of Hobab is that the Amalekites hated Israel. But Hobab and his descendants loved Israel and blessed Israel and helped Israel. Those who love God's people will get the blessings that come from God's people, and those who hate God's people will get God's curses. So next we move on to chapter 11, where it says that the people of Israel start to complain against God. We've already seen them complain multiple times in the book of Exodus, and now here they are complaining again. And this time, God's fed up, and it says that the fire of God is kindled in the outskirts of the camp and starts consuming stuff. And so then the people freak out, and they call out to Moses, and Moses prays to God, and the fire goes out. So it doesn't explicitly say that anyone died here, but it does say that God was really angry, and that was a dangerous situation for Israel to be in. But it then goes on to immediately say that the people of Israel keep complaining. The people of Israel basically say, where are we going to get meat? All we have is a manna. Back in Egypt, we had fish, we had cucumbers, we had garlic, we had leeks and onions. We could eat whatever we wanted. But now we're out here in the desert and all we have is manna. Man, I wish we could go back to Egypt. And so at this point, it actually says that Moses starts crying out to God. He basically is kvetching to God and saying, why are you being so hard on me? If I found favor in your sight, then let me just die. I didn't give birth to this people, so why do I have to carry this people around and nurse this people and do everything all by myself? God, why are you doing this to me? Why are you putting all this responsibility on me? So God settles two issues at once. Basically, the two issues are the people of Israel are grumpy and want meat, and Moses is grumpy and he needs help. So first God says, get 70 of the elders of Israel and bring them here, and I will make them helpers for Moses. And it says that God is going to take some of his spirit, which he's put on Moses. He's going to take a little bit of it and give a portion of that to the 70 elders. As then they'll be able to help Moses in caring for and judging the people of Israel.
This is very similar to what we saw when Jethro gave counsel to Moses, telling him, it's not right for you to be judging these people on every little thing all day when it's too much for you and for the people. And he said, get some help. Get people who can divide the workload and do some of the things that you are doing to help you so that the burden's not all on you. And so now when Moses is bringing this problem to God, God is offering a solution. He's giving Moses people to help him. people who are guided by that same Spirit of God.
Now, interestingly, it says that when God put his Spirit on the elders, they started to prophesy. They prophesied just this once. They didn't ever do it again. But it showed that God's Spirit was in these people and was moving in these people. And in fact, there were two of the elders who actually weren't there at the time. So they were elsewhere in the camp and they started prophesying somewhere else. And people came to Moses and said, look, these two guys are prophesying. And it says that Joshua, who is Moses' right-hand man and his helper, he says, do you want me to go and stop them from prophesying? And Moses says, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that Adonai would put his Spirit upon them. So I found this really interesting, the way that Moses puts this here. I wish that all of Adonai's people would have God's Spirit and would prophesy. It reminded me of the prophet Joel. In Joel it says, thus you will know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am Adonai your God, and there is no other, and my people will never be put to shame. It will come about after this that I will pour out my Spirit on all mankind, and your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams, your young men will see visions. So it feels like Moses is kind of alluding to this same kind of thing, as he wishes that one day everyone in Israel will prophesy and have God's Spirit living in them. And of course, the words of Joel were fulfilled in the book of Acts when God poured out his Spirit on the believers and they started speaking in other languages and proclaiming the good things of God. And Peter quoted that verse and said, that is happening today. And if you accept Yeshua, then this can happen to you too. So this just goes to show that this awesome thing that could happen of all the people of Israel prophesying and having God's Spirit, that can happen through Yeshua. Moses' wish for the people of Israel comes through the prophet like Moses, Yeshua the Messiah.
This concept where some people started doing a miracle and Joshua's response was, stop them. And Moses says, why? Are you jealous for me? Everyone should be doing this. It reminded me of something from the New Covenant scriptures. Yeshua's disciples said to him, teacher, we saw a certain one casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him, since he does not follow us. And Yeshua said, forbid him not, for there is no one who will do a powerful act in my name and will be able quickly to speak evil of me. For he who is not against us is for us. So, kind of like Joshua, the disciples saw someone doing a powerful act in the name of Yeshua. And the response was, we've got to stop this because he's not one of us. Mm. But Yeshua is saying, whenever a powerful act is done, if it's done in his name, then it's a good thing. There's no reason you should try to stop it because it is accomplishing work for God. Mm. And anyone who is not against us is for us. So anyone who is furthering the cause of Yeshua, how can he be against Yeshua? And so I think this shows just because someone's not specifically following exactly the way you're following doesn't mean that the work he's doing has to be stopped. Mm. If his work is being done in the name of God and is accomplishing God's work, then there's no reason to stop it except jealousy. Mm. And we should not be jealous about ourselves or about each other even. We should only be trying to do God's work. And anyone who is doing powerful acts in God's name and is actually furthering God's work is doing work that should not be stopped. We should always seek to work in whatever way possible to get God's work done, as long as that way is not against God's work. So now at this point, Moses has the help he needs. But there's still the other problem, that the people of Israel are complaining and wanting to go back to Egypt. Now, this is ridiculous. These are the same people who suffered their entire lives in Egypt. Mm. But since they got free, they've been doing a lot of complaining. We saw, as soon as they were free, their initial reaction was, we're thirsty, why'd you bring us out here to die? We're hungry, why'd you bring us out here to die? There's been lots of complaining, but God provided for them through all of that. And now, God has given them his covenant, his Torah, his priesthood, and he is leading them to the promised land. They are on their way there, and they're still complaining. Mm. It's as if they've seen nothing, and they don't even remember where they came from. God has been providing them the manna every single day.
For the last year.
And their response is to be dissatisfied. They are rejecting God's provision. They're completely discontented. And they're saying, we would be more satisfied in slavery to our past then we are serving God, following him, and him providing for our every need. And the whole reason why they would rather slavery than God is because they crave meat. And so we see that what it comes down to is that the people of Israel are more interested in satisfying their own desires than in following God. And because of this, God is actually going to give them exactly what they're asking for. But he's also going to punish them. So the people of Israel want meat. God says they're going to get meat. God's going to give them meat, not just for a day or for 2 days or for a week, for a whole month. God is going to give them meat until it comes out of their nostrils and becomes loathsome to them because they have rejected Adonai, who is among them. So God is giving them exactly what they want, but that doesn't mean they're going to like it. And so on the next day, God sends quail, tons and tons and tons of quail that fills the camp and goes a day's journey on either side, 2 cubits above the ground. There is just so much quail, and they are having to wade through the quail. And so all the people get up and gather all the quail. Quail bonanza. But then it says, while they were still eating the meat, God sent a plague, and it killed a whole bunch of people, a very great plague. And so it says that the people of Israel named the place Kivrot Hata'ava, which means graves of craving, because there they buried the people who had the craving. So we see that the people who are more interested in satisfying their own desires than in following God, to the point that they were willing to go back to Egypt and submit to slavery, those people got exactly what they wanted, but they also got death. Because ultimately, that is the end of what happens when we follow our desires. Yaakov says that each one is tempted, being led away and enticed by his own desires. Afterward, the desire, having conceived, gives birth to sin. And the sin, having become fully grown, brings forth death. Be not led astray, my beloved brothers. We should always be following God and trusting in his provision. But if instead we allow our own desires to lead us astray and we go follow after them, then we will walk into sin. Sin is exactly what the people of Israel did when they grumbled against God and rejected their God. And so as a result of following their desires into sin, they ended at death. This should be a lesson for all of us. If we follow our own desires, we may get what we want, but we'll also get into a world of sin. If we remain there, we will end up only arriving at death. Yeshua gives life, but if we want that life, we have to follow him. If we instead follow our own desires, it leads to death.
I'm remembering in previous times when Israel had grumbled against God, they had said, "We wish we had died in Egypt. We just don't want to keep eating this manna," is what they're saying here. And so God is like, "I'll give you exactly what you want. You won't be eating this manna anymore, and you'll be dead." Sometimes God will give us exactly what we ask for, and we will end up in an awful place. God is life. He is the giver of life, and his ways are life. And when we say we don't want what God is giving us, then what we are saying is we want death. And in a similar way to how God hardened Pharaoh's heart when he was proud against Israel and he was proud against God, God basically firmed him up in that, hardened him so that he could punish Pharaoh more. In this case, God was basically enabling the people of Israel to stray from him because that's what they wanted. God was like, "Okay, I'm going to give you what you're asking for, but you aren't going to like where it ends up." And there are other places in scripture, like in the Psalms, where David complains that it seems like God is helping and blessing the wicked people. But I think that this just goes to show, just because God is giving you something to help you in what you want, doesn't mean that what you want is righteous. You need to realize that sometimes God will give you things to punish you, to discipline you, to show you the consequences of straying from his ways. And so the question is, are you going to listen to God when he is showing you, "This is what comes of straying from me"? Or will you lean further into that and go further away from God and then end up at that final result, which is death?
Yeshua said that he is the bread that came down out of the heaven. He is the manna. And anyone who eats him will live. But if you do not eat the flesh of the Son of Man, you have no life in yourselves.
Mm.
The people of Israel were actively rejecting God's provision of life.
Mm.
Because instead of being satisfied with God's provision, they were only satisfied with their own desires, which resulted in death. So we have to decide if we are going to be satisfied with Yeshua's provision of everlasting life, if we will be satisfied with Him. Because instead, if we will be satisfied with our own desires, we won't have life.
Mm.
We'll only have death. But Yeshua gives life if we are satisfied with Him. He is all the provision we need.
But on the flip side, Paul says to make no provision for the flesh for satisfying its lusts. Following Yeshua is very unsatisfying for our flesh. And so the question is, what kind of things will we be satisfied? The things that satisfy our flesh, or the things which God provides for us for good and for life? So now we get to the last chapter in this portion, where it basically says that Moses is confronted by Aaron and Miriam, his siblings. Apparently, Moses had taken a Cushite wife, that would be an Ethiopian wife, and Miriam and Aaron want to confront Moses about this. And they're basically trying to say, we have the authority to judge you because you're not the only one God speaks through. He speaks through us too. And so they're trying to establish their own authority over Moses. Now, after this, Moses writes down, "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth." Now, a lot of jokes have been made about this, about Moses writing this about himself. But the point is, it doesn't say here anywhere that Moses responds directly to Aaron and Miriam's rebuke. He doesn't defend himself. He isn't trying to establish his own authority.
Going all the way back to Exodus, we saw that Moses didn't even want this job.
Mm.
When God chose Moses, Moses' response was, "Who am I?
Mm.
I'm not right for this. Surely you can pick someone else. Please send someone else." But God said no. God is the one who picked Moses. And that's what Miriam and Aaron aren't realizing here. When they're going up against Moses, Moses isn't going to defend himself because Moses isn't the one who put himself in this position.
Mm.
God put Moses in this position. And so Miriam and Aaron are going up against God's choice.
Mm.
And so God is going to defend his choice.
It says at this point, "Suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, 'You three come to the tent of meeting.'" And so the pillar of cloud comes and stands at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So rather than being over the Ark of the Covenant, it's at the doorway of the tent of meeting now, and God is speaking to the three of them. And so what God says here is, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, Adonai, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, and not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of Adonai. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses?" And then it says that the anger of Adonai burned against them, and he departed. And then after that, Miriam gets covered with Tzara'at, which we read about in previous portions, which is an unclean disease all over her skin, such that she now needs to go outside the camp away from the presence of God. And she has to be out there for 7 days as punishment for speaking against Moses. Now, I really want to point out here that God is contrasting Moses with all other prophets. He's saying with normal prophets, God gives them visions and dreams, and he speaks to them in dark sayings, basically in confusing ways. But with Moses, as we read previously, God speaks to him face to face as a man speaks to his friend, or as it's said here, he speaks to him mouth to mouth, and he speaks openly. He speaks plainly. Everything that God has said to Moses has been plain, direct, and easy to understand. There's no mystery about it here. And so God is revealing himself to Moses in a way that he doesn't reveal himself to any other people. As Hosea said, Moses was chosen by God uniquely. He is the only one in this position, and no one else has the authority to speak against Moses. Now, I really wanted to bring this up in the context of what we'll read later in Deuteronomy, which says that God will raise up a prophet like Moses from among the people of Israel. God here is saying that Moses is not like other prophets. He is greater than other prophets. And then later in Deuteronomy, God will raise up another prophet like Moses. And we see this prophet like Moses in the master Yeshua. Nowhere in scripture does it record Yeshua as having a dream or a vision from God. On the contrary, it says that the Father has shown everything to the Son. And also here, it says that Moses beholds the form of Adonai. And Philippians says that Yeshua was in God's form. So not just beholding God's form, but in God's form himself. And rather than speaking to Moses face to face like a man speaks to his friend, Yeshua is the Son of God. He's greater than a friend. He is God's Son. So we just see in all these different ways that Moses and Yeshua are alike, and Yeshua even surpasses Moses. Moses surpasses all other prophets, and then Yeshua goes even beyond that. Yeshua is a prophet, but he's far greater than any other prophet, greater even than Moses.
So I think the big takeaway from this portion is be content with what God gives you. The people of Israel were not content with God's provision of manna, which he gave to them every single day to sustain their lives. Instead, they rejected his provision and said, "We'd rather be slaves." And so as a result of seeking their own desires and rejecting God's provision, they were also rejecting God. Mm. And the result was death. When they refused to receive what God provided to them for life, they had no life. Mm. So also we see Miriam and Aaron were not content with the position that God had given them among the people of Israel. They wanted to be better than Moses. But we see that God gives to each person the job he wants them to do. He provides for them as long as they are doing what he wants them to do. So we should always be content with the path God gives us. We should always be content with the food God provides for us, which is Yeshua and everlasting life.
That wraps up the portion of Baha'alotcha. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion of Shalach Lecha. So be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation so that we can make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.